Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep begins now.
Someone ate the baby. It's rather sad to say. Someone ate the baby, so she won't be out to play. We'll never hear her whiny cry or have to feel if she is dry. We'll never hear her asking, why? Someone ate the baby. Someone ate the baby. It is absolutely clear. Someone ate the baby because the baby isn't here. We'll give away her toys and clothes. And we'll never have to wipe her nose. Dad says, that's the way it goes. Someone ate the baby. Someone ate the baby. What a frightful thing to eat. Someone ate the baby, though she wasn't very sweet. It was a heartless thing to do. The policemen haven't got a clue. I simply can't imagine who would go and eat the baby.
It is 19 minutes after the hour of 1 in this, the month of August, in the year of our Lord, 2010. Thank you for coming along and making a part of your listening day. We are live from the plushly appointed yet not overly ostentatious studios of the Emerson News Network. This, my friends, is the Rick Emerson Radio Program, an excursion into whimsy and amusements of all varieties, in ways beyond counting. There you go. That is my favorite Shel Silverstein composition right there, read by the author. It is the Rick Emerson Radio Show. It's 503-505-6964. 503-505-6964. If you would like to join us, then hold on. Let me set the thing to Skype me. There we go. Which sounds like something. Sounds like some sort of an unpleasant medical procedure that you're preparing to have done. But you know, what do I know? There you go. 503-505-6964. If you'd like to weigh in with your comments, questions, clarifications, kvetches. I used to have another thing I would say. Calls, questions, see, now I can't even do it. If you'd like to comment with your call, now I'm trying to think my way through it, and I can't actually make it work. 503-505-6964 with your comments, questions, clarifications, kvetches, something else, and then I would say, or musings of an ironic nature. Recipes? Excoriations? Threats? Marriage proposals? Butter? Nothing works there. Begonia? Guppy? Boutros Ghali? No, none of these things work. Well, whatever. The other thing that's there. The point is, there's a phone, and you pick it up and you dial it, and we'll answer. And then the rest is up to you. As that guy found out yesterday, I forget his name, Tom, I think. As Tom found out yesterday, you pick up the phone, you call, we answer, we say hello, you speak. And then if the call is an abject failure, that's kind of on you at that point. That's I can't be held responsible. I mean, I know some people. I mean, occasionally people will try to hold me responsible for that, but I can be held responsible for almost nothing. That's the thing. I've honed that to a razor-sharp point, that particular talent of my personality, that aspect of my persona. I can escape responsibility, if only by just ignoring you. That's the thing. This is confidential to everybody. All right. I guess if it's to everybody, it's not confidential. You know what I mean? If you'd like to email, it's rick@rickemerson.com. rick@rickemerson.com. I never really put that together when I would read Dear Abby as a youth. When she would say, like, confidential to kvetching in, you know, Cucamonga, if it's in the newspaper, it's not really confidential at all. There's nothing confidential about it. If she's not using your name, doesn't mean it's confidential. If she's putting it, if, like, Reuters is distributing it to 25,000 newspapers or whatever the hell, it's not confidential at all. That was misidentified by Abigail Van Buren or Popo or whatever the hell her name is. What is her name?
I don't remember.
It doesn't really matter. All right. It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. If you'd like to email, you can do that as well. It's rick@rickemerson.com. Rick at RickEmerson.com. Don Taylor can be reached. Don Taylor, underhost of The Rick Emerson Show, which is how you're identified on the contact page, by the way. You go to the contact page and it says Rick Emerson. I think I'm Maven. And then you're identified as underhost.
Right.
And then there's, oh, by the way, we have added, after repeated request, and by the way, the prospective advertiser should be listening when I say this. After repeated request by the audience to have the information, like sort of a Rick Emerson kind of yellow pages thing, if you go to the contact section of RickEmerson.com, we've actually added a little box that has contact information for all of our many paying sponsors. So you can go there and figure out how to get in touch with them. Yes, Don?
A number of people in the text box have popped up. They believe that the word you were searching for earlier was ruminations.
503-556 with your comments, questions, clarifications, ruminations, ponderings, music of an ironic nature. I could see that. The meter works. The cadence of it sort of flows. Comments, questions, clarifications, ruminations, ponderings, musings of an ironic nature. Here's the thing. Maybe that's right. Maybe it's not. It seems like the anecdotal evidence is such that it is right. I'm going to act as though it's right regardless. We're going to plunge on ahead. Thank you, good people of wherever you are. Thank you. Of Emersonia. Thank you. And so, therefore, this is, yes. Hi, Don.
Hiya.
How are you?
I'm good.
All right. Coming up today, Corpse Watch, Religious Nutcase Watch. Both of these are except, if the Corpse Watch is what I think it is, and I don't know, it could be, I could be way off. They're both fantastic. Corpse Watch, Religious Nutcase Watch. We have today's Pop Culture Authority, which I think is printed out. Wait, hold on. It's right here. I hold it in my, right here. That's the sound of knowledge. Today's Pop Culture Authority, what is the punchline to Bender's joke in The Breakfast Club?
And that is piping hot, fresh off the presses,
right
too, because you were actually tippy-typing that up during the break.
That's right.
Finishing it up.
Now it's ready to go.
Sending it from your brain to the computer, to the printer.
Right here. There's so much, hold on, there's so much knowledge in this that it muffles my voice substantially if I put it in front of the microphone. That is the, that's the thickness and girth of this knowledge right there.
It's turgid.
It is. It's. I'm too messant with facts. They will be, and then I will just spray them in your general direction later on. So what is the punchline to Bender's joke in The Breakfast Club? That's today's Pop Culture Authority. That's, I'm going to set that over here, right over at Nya, so that I don't, and then throwing that away. There you go. All right. It's 503-505-6964. Also coming up today, well, we got a whole bunch of stuff left over from yesterday, basically. But it doesn't mean they're leftovers as such, just things that have been sort of cropping up. As is always the case, things just crop up faster than they can be gotten to. I mean, they just pile up with just amazing speed. For instance, are you aware, Don Taylor? That you said, well, before I even reveal this, what headlines are you working on for the good people of Portland today?
Well, climbers are going to be trying to recover human remains on Mount Hood. We got some stuff and nonsense about the White House and embryonic stem research and federal judges, etc. And a man dies during his bachelor party.
All right, excellent. And by excellent, I mean, because here's the thing, it'll let me finish my bachelor party story from yesterday.
Indeed.
Or whenever that was. I never really got a chance to talk about it. Where they were always getting, you know, like low-grade, like low-budget whores. Are you aware, though, that you said, I think on Friday you said this. When did I start talking?
Is this part of the list that you were making, apparently, of odd things I've said?
Yeah, and also, like, when did I start talking like Jackie Mason? On Friday you said this. On the paper it's written. You said, and this is a quote because it's got quotes around it.
Okay.
My shoes smell like popcorn. What is up with that? Why would you ever say that?
Because they did.
I guess I understand what it means, but I'm saying what? Like, hey, how would you learn? How would you determine? Did you put your nose in and smell them?
Well, I had it close enough to my face I could smell. I guess I was curious to see how badly they. I have these shoes, and I've been wearing them without socks because then I come in here to the studio and I slip my feet out of my shoes.
Oh, I know.
And I walk around barefoot.
Yeah, I know. I'm aware. We're all aware of that.
Although I have told you not to ever look at my feet.
And it's not that your feet smell. Don't get me wrong. They don't. I mean, they might smell of something, but they don't smell. There's no smell that they don't smell bad, certainly. There's nothing I can. In other words, they have no discernible scent. I cannot ever tell. I don't go, but somebody's
do you
got just, her shoes off.
Do you just, is this one of those things you have a thing about? Is barefootedness?
Well, keep in mind, first of all, please understand, this is not you specific, so please don't take this personally. This
okay.
is not. It's amazing how many times I have to say that to people. Don't take this personally. And then it never works because they do. Without exception, to a man, they take it personally.
I'm fairly sure that whatever this is, since it's just about my feet, it probably won't bother me too much.
It's just like it kind of, in a low-grade way, Like, it's not like it prevents me from, like, it takes me out of show mode or something. It kind of grosses me out. The whole, like, walking around in the workplace or just ever, like, in bare feet. But that's me. See, that's the thing where I realize that's me. That's not the rest of the world. Like, I got a whole, well, I told you that when I get up, when I get up and I get dressed all the way. I get dressed, socks, shoes, whatever my outfit is going to be for that day. Now, sometimes if it's really, really hot, I'm going to be outside, I have, like, whatever, you know, shorts on or something. Not very often, but sometimes. But it's like, whatever I'm going to wear, I don't have, like, an intermediary outfit or, like, an interstitial set of, you know, like, garb that I put on. I get dressed, like, full on, 100%. And I don't ever walk around barefoot. I get out of the shower, I put on socks and shoes immediately. Wow. I do not like to be barefoot. And so it's that thing where when something is weird to you, and then when you see somebody else doing it, it kind of is like a it's like a secondhand weirdness. It's like a tangential weirdness. That's the thing when you're like prepping for the show. Do you just now, is it just here?
No, I'm barefoot.
Do you have shoes on now?
No.
All right. I can't see. So.
No. Although I could kind of split the difference. I could, like, slip my shoes on whenever I'm walking about, and then you don't have to see me there.
It's okay. I mean, it's not like it's not going to stop me. I'm a professional. I'll rise above it.
I basically only wear shoes when I have to.
That's weird. How do I put this? I don't mean it's weird as such. I mean, that's weird for you. It surprises me that you would walk around shoeless. It seems like that would bug you. It seems like you are you got a lot of the same hang-ups I do, and yeah. It seems like that would not be a thing, that you would find it oogie in some way.
Well, part of it is, and this might make it even more oogie for you, I don't know, but the part of the thing is that I went through this thing about a year or so ago. I started getting like eczema on my feet, itchy feet.
Right.
And if I wear like socks and shoes for like extended periods of time, like if I have my shoes and socks on for like 14 hours, if I get up and put them on and then I have them on forever, which
you
I do
green,
during the
scaly
winter.
Skin.
No, my feet just get really itchy. So I need to like actually, if I'm barefoot and they're sort of exposed to the air, I don't get weird, itchy feet.
Have you tried Gold Bond medicated powder?
I have indeed.
Really?
Yes, I have.
I almost bought some Gold Bond. I got a whole thing with like hand lotion where I don't like my hands get real dry or whatever, which is like a family. It's like a family trait, apparently, because my grandfather, who was very masculine in many ways, had like endless bottles of sort of fruity, like rose milk, you know, or whatever that crap was called, lotion around. So I got a thing with a hand lotion.
Yeah.
I was buying some more hand lotion the other day, and I almost bought Gold Bond medicated hand lotion because I've had that drilled into me from talk radio commercials like forever.
I've used the Gold Bond powder. I've used just baby powder like in my socks. I had this powder I got from Lush that is made of like ground up clay and has like lime and lime juice in it.
Does it work?
No.
But what is it supposed to do,
first
of all?
It's supposed to help keep your feet dry so they don't get weird and itchy.
Right.
I guess if it's a bacterial thing, bacteria grow in moist, warm environments. So you want to keep your feet.
Your feet are covered in bacteria?
Everything is covered in bacteria.
This is the sexiest conversation ever, by the way.
Anyway, but my feet are fine because during the, you know, I slip my shoes off and I walk around. But, so I have these shoes and they have a little liner thing in the bottom of them. They're like Land's End slip-on shoes. And the liner in one of them got kind of bunched up. So I picked up my shoe on Friday and was adjusting the liner. And then I had the thing where, you know how leather shoes can get, like, really stinky. And
yes.
I don't want to have stinky shoes.
No.
So I was kind of, I think, doing a check to make sure I don't have...
How does it smell bad?
Yes, stinky shoes.
Yes.
So it was like, God, I hope this doesn't smell bad.
Yeah.
And I took a sniff, and weirdly, it did not smell like stinky feet. It smelled like popcorn.
Okay, that is bizarre.
And so that's why I said, wow, my shoe smells like popcorn.
Was it like
strange.
A buttered popcorn?
It's just kind of a toasty popcorn.
Not a strange flavor. It wasn't like it didn't taste like a sour cream and onion popcorn or something. It was just sort of a regular popcorn smell.
Yeah, just kind of a warm, toasty popcorny smell.
Interesting.
It was strange.
All right, well there you go. And that's the end of that conversation. it's fine. You know, that's whatever. Again, your feet don't smell bad, and the hang up is mine. Like it's just like seeing anybody walk around on carpet without their shoes. I get a whole not to make myself sound crazier than I am, even, but I got this thing with, and I have been told, I had a shrink, one of my many, many shrinks told me this. I had this shrink who was actually, he was really great because he did, I think I told this story when it happened. It was sort of great and terrible all at once because I ended up not seeing him anymore because he was the shrink that told me that I was wasting my time. He said, yeah, you're just wasting your money here, man. And I just went, well, like, okay, points for honesty. I got to go. Bye now. And but he was sort of great and creepy because this is when you realize it was depressing and cheering all at once to realize that, you know, A, you are just like a collection of cliches, you know, whoever you are. And then B, but also that you're not as bizarre maybe as you're sometimes afraid. Because like the first time I met him, I told him like three things about me. And he immediately then guessed like 10 things about me that were all correct. Like absolute, like to the finest detail. I told him, he's like, well, what's your deal? And you know, what's your crazy? And I said, well, blah, 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 1, 2, 3. And he went, oh, those three things. Well, I would then imagine, based on that, I would extrapolate out and assume that also you are blah, blah, blah. And he listed 10 things, and they were, like, all, like, astonishingly accurate. And it's not like he'd done, like, a pre-interview with, like, well, this is your life, where he thought that my family or somebody. It was bizarre. And so it was sort of like, well, okay, I'm not that crazy. And then he went, well, I'm just a big stereotype. But what was my point? Oh, so we were talking about OCD things. I mean, I know I'm not, like, as OCD as some people. Like, I don't have to wash my hands, like, 1,000 times a day or whatever. But he did note that in his experience as a clinician, that OCD people had many times a disproportionately negative response to certain textures. And I am that way with... Can I just tell you this? I don't even like to think about it. I just sit on my hands, actually, okay, when I talk about this because it makes me cringe. This sounds retarded, but anybody who knows, do you have a texture thing? Are there textures that really, like, you can't even think about it because they just drive you up the wall?
Textures and sounds and smells. There are certain things that I just can't handle. I can't deal.
Laura and I have this toaster oven at home, this Black & Decker toaster oven, of which I'm quite fond, by the way, and I love it. It's a great toaster oven. There is this, I don't know what you call it, it's like a braising pan, maybe? It's not, there are no holes in the bottom of it. It doesn't drain. It's just, maybe it's just for stuff that would fall through the grill otherwise. Like,
okay,
if you're toasting French fries or something. Yeah. But it's just like a metal pan that is removable. And the texture of this, I can't even, it's almost hard to describe it because it makes me cringe. You can actually see me, I'm like shifting uncontrollably in my seat. The texture, the feel of the metal that this pan is made out of. And it's just a metal pan. It's like a little, it looks like a cookie sheet, basically. A little deeper. The feel of the metal, I actually have to, I know this sounds just completely retarded. I actually have to get the cooking gloves, the hot pad things that you put on your hand to open the oven. I actually have to put those on to touch it. And even then, I know what it feels like because I picked it up accidentally.
Isn't it just... shiny, slick metal?
It's not slick, though. It's not a slick metal, and it's not rough, either. It's like a... What's the word I'm looking for?
Oh, I know what you're talking about.
But what is
the,
it? It's not...
The polish.
It's not.
Kind of thing.
But it's not polished. It's...
No, but I know what you mean. It's like the kind of rough it up and make it sort of a matte.
It's like a matte. It's like a matte metal.
Oh, my God, yes. Because they do that on a whole lot of... faucets.
It's like
and
unfinished
now?
Metal. It's like an unfinished
they call it
metal.
Like brushed something or something.
And it is, or like brushed steel.
And I see that, and I've never actually talked to anybody else about this. I see it. They make faucets and things out of it now, and I hate it.
I can't even touch it. I seriously, and this is not the. Not hyperbole when I have to put, and the thing is, I got it for her for Christmas, and so I was getting it all set up, and because we're romantic, so I got her a toaster oven, because I'm hot, but I, you know, so I was setting it up, and then I was, and we made cookies or something on Christmas, something like gay and coupley, and but I had to touch it, and a couple times, and the first time I was like, well, that's weird, and then I touched it again, touching it. Here's the only way I can describe it: touching the metal pan in my toaster oven at home is like when you chew on tinfoil. And you're cringing. And that's what it does to me, though. But now I know what it feels like. So even putting on, the hot gloves or whatever doesn't help all the way. But at least that lets me handle it. I cannot touch the thing without having gloves on because it freaks my nervous system out. And I know that that's crazy. I know you're not supposed to... People aren't supposed to be wired like that. But the shrink told me. He's like, hey, do you have OCD? And I said, well, a little. And he said, are there certain textures that actually are so uncomfortable? They don't hurt, but just they're so... How did he put it? Are there certain textures that make your skin crawl so much you can't even pick things up? And I said, couple. And he said, uh-huh. And he literally He took out a pen and he literally checked something off a list in front of him. So there you go. I don't even know why we're talking about this, but there you go.
Two things I've got that are like that. One is I can't eat raw cauliflower.
Right.
Because it squeaks against my teeth.
Yeah, what about cheese curds?
I have tried.
A squeaky food?
I've tried to eat cheese curds because I like the idea of cheese curds, but they squeak.
I can't do that.
But the one thing that is really horrible that I just really can't deal with like that is the sound of a shovel scraping on concrete.
Oh, yeah.
And I don't know. I've always heard the thing about people saying nails on chalkboard and stuff, and I've heard people do their nails on chalkboard. That really doesn't bother me.
See, I don't like it, but it doesn't bother me either.
Scraping a shovel on concrete.
Yeah.
It makes my teeth ache.
See,
everything in my body just screams.
I'm with you. And it is like you're getting a current run through your body. And that sound, the shovel sound, that didn't bother me. But I totally know what you're talking about. The nails on chalkboard thing also, and I'll quit saying that phrase because I know that probably bugs people, the way that the shovel thing does you. I really care for it, but it doesn't do to me what it does to other people. So I think maybe there's just like a plug, like in your head or my head, that just like it ought to be for nails and chalkboard. For me, it's like metal pan in toaster oven. For you, it's like shovel and whatever. I got noises like that too that I can't. Yeah, it's like you can't even hear them because I got to quit talking about it. Anyway. I can't. And by the way, just one. At one point, I don't even know where we got it. But at one point, Laura had somehow come into possession of a fork that was made out of that same brushed metal that's in the toaster oven. And I accidentally was like eating with it, and it was just the sort of tine part. And I put it in my mouth, and I immediately my brain was like, gauga, dive. It was like alarm. It was the same metal. And it's like, and I think she thought I had gotten like glass or something. And because I like dropped the fork and I actually stood up from the table and I went, I'll be back in a second. And I actually had to go brush my teeth. God damn, we sound crazy.
Yeah.
Wow.
Do.
All right. Well, we'll get to the news here in a second. Lots to get through today. We got the Pop Culture Authority. What is the end to Bender's joke in The Breakfast Club? Corpse Watch, Religious Nutcase Watch. I got to talk about. So I never did discuss my audition from this weekend. We got to get to that. And then I have another. Here's the thing. We got to end on time today because Greg and Sarah are going to be in. And then I got another audition today. So that'll be exciting. I should just tell you a little bit about my audition today. They will work backward to later on. We'll do this weekend's audition. I'm just going to say this. Here's the only reason I'm getting it, because today's audition is not unlike the one I had over the weekend. And it's the worst kind of auditioning for me, because most of my stuff is like voice work, where it's just, like radio commercials, or even if it's a TV commercial, I'm not the guy in camera. I'm the guy saying, on sale all this week at Radio Shack, where America loves to shop, or, whatever, where I'm, have I talked about the Barnum & Bailey commercial? Funundrum. Barnum & Bailey's Funundrum. Which is the name of their newest touring sensation or whatever. So it's like me behind a microphone like for 100, 100 times in a row saying, Funundrum, 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 Funundrum. Trying to figure out how to say Barnum & Bailey's Funundrum. So it's like just a voiceover audition most of the time. Very rarely do I have on-camera auditions where if I got the gig, it would be on camera, on screen. I am just the voice most of the time. But the ones on screen, it sucks because it sounds so dumb. But it's one of those ones where I have to do all this acting. And by that I mean there's no dialogue. It's just like a physical acting where there's no dialogue at all. It's just like, okay, now you're on the subway. Okay, the subway is jostling you. Ooh, now there's somebody loud talking on the subway and you're irritated because you're trying to read the New York Times. Okay, now glare over, and there's no subway, there's no newspaper, there's nothing. But they're saying like, okay, now glare over your newspaper at the loud guy. You know what I mean? There's, now a homeless man is on the subway. He's rattling his cup, asking you for change. And I'm sitting in a chair in Portland in the casting agent's office with none of these things and no dialogue, which, of course, is the only thing I'm really good at, is talking. And so I can kind of act vocally. But I don't know what the hell it looks like if you're on a subway and a guy's rattling his cup and I'm looking over my newspaper at him. This is just a thing I can't do. And so I know you're not supposed to say that as an actor. Like, I don't know how to do that. But,
You haven't have you watched Louis on FX yet?
No, I keep meaning to and I haven't.
One of his episodes recently, he is requested by Matthew Broderick to play a small role in a movie. And he doesn't want to do it because he hates acting.
Yeah.
But his ancient agent bullies him into it. And the scenes with him trying to actually act opposite Matthew Broderick, who's becoming increasingly disillusioned with him, are utterly hilarious. And it made me think of you.
I love that guy. I keep meaning to watch that show, so maybe I'll do that this weekend or something. Well, that's the thing. And
him standing there in a policeman's uniform having to say, "He's dead, sir," and not being able to say it in any kind of a way that sounds like a human would actually say it.
And that's my thing, is I just can't sound sincere. I just can't sound like a real person, ever. Ever. I can't, even when I am sincere, I don't sound sincere. So that's the thing. And then the agent, just as with Louis C.K., apparently, would you know that must be based on real life? You know that's that nobody just comes up with that unless they've lived that. And it's like my agent just keeps sending me on these things. And Laura asked me last night, she's like, you know, why don't you just say no? You just pass. And I'm like, I can't do that because the thing is, you know, the agent, of course, works on commission. All agents, you know, reputable agents, most of them, they work on commission. In other words, Maury doesn't get paid unless I get paid. And, you know, Maury and his deadbeat brother, Ira, who lives above him and, you know, lives in the space above his family's garage or whatever. So Maury has got to make his, 12% or whatever. And so if I don't make, if I don't make the $100, Maury didn't make the $12. And so when Maury sends me an audition, I got to go because otherwise I'm basically telling him, Maury, I don't care about your 12%. I don't care about the children you got to put through Harvard or whatever. So I have to go because otherwise I'm the client who doesn't want to make money, which is just absurd. And then I'm the client who doesn't want to make money for him. And then they stop sending you on auditions.
Yeah.
And then you don't get on leverage. So that's the thing. Final note about this, and then we'll go to the news desk. Here's the special little fillip of absurdity about today's audition. I won't say who it's for because that would be inappropriate at this time. I will say that, and it says this like 9 different times in the email I got from Maury's assistant. It said, hey, kid, tomorrow you got to be at this, this place at 4. It actually says repeatedly in the casting notes where it will say, sometimes it'll say, we're looking for a European type, or, we're looking for a young hipster sort, or, we're looking for a stylish older gentleman. This one says, 5 times, we're looking for, I swear to God, a rugged outdoorsman. Thank you. Thank you for laughing.
And this is the role you are
sending
are reading
me.
For.
I'm not even reading. That's the thing. I'm not even reading. I'm just acting physically somehow as though I were, a rugged outdoorsman.
Are you putting on a plaid shirt before you go?
Do you know how many people have said to me in the last 12 hours, have you put on a plaid shirt? including the assistant. So I call my agent, and I'm talking to his assistant. I go, hey, I'm going to this rugged outdoorsman thing, on Tuesday. And I just asked him, what is up with this? How do I look like a rugged? If I could speak, if I was allowed to read lines, but there are, it's not even that they're not allowed to. There are no lines in the commercial. It's like there's going to be a voiceover, and then there'll be a guy on screen looking like a rugged outdoorsman. And I just asked the guy at my agent's office. I'm like, this is the assistant, and I said, hey, so Jeff, how do I look like a rugged outdoorsman? And he goes, and this is what he said. He said, I don't know, just look like one of those Northwest dudes. And then I gotta go, bye. And he hung up, and I was like, okay. Then he sent me an email, he's like, wear some flannel. So everybody wants me to basically dress like the brawny towel guy.
Yeah, you're gonna walk into a room, and there's gonna be 12 other guys who are all wearing plaid shirts and North Face fleece vests. And, of course, it's 90 degrees outside today, so.
And the casting agents, RAI or something is, on the way, so I could stop there. But what would be the point of that?
Yeah.
So I'm going to go. You know what I'm going to do? Here's my concession to this. I am wearing today boots instead of shoes.
Okay.
There you go, my boots. And I'm going to take off my bracelets. Because that's not, otherwise I'm sort of Fire Island rugged. So yeah. I'm going to take these off, and that's it. And then that's what you get, baby. Mm-hmm. You get me. And maybe I look like a rugged outdoorsman. I can't even say it without laughing. Maybe I look like a rugged outdoorsman. Maybe I don't. But this is what they're getting. Rugged outdoorsman, Don.
Yeah.
Me.
Sure.
Yeah. All right. Thank you so much. All right.
And now, from the news desk, this is Don Taylor.
And how was your night, Don?
Oh, it was good. Hung out with the husband. We We spent some time deciding what kind of crappy food we were going to buy since we didn't want to cook. And after eschewing pizza, we got some food from Chipotle. And I discovered, this is interesting, the Chipotle by my house, I don't know how many of them do this. I assume many of them do. If you order online, they actually, when you arrive to pay, it's like, get like the second meal free.
Really?
Yeah. So actually, so both of us ate for like $6.
Awesome.
And then I only ate half of it, and I brought the rest in earlier and had it for leftovers for lunch.
Is that what you were having earlier? That actually smelled quite good.
Cost effective, yeah. It was some kind of shredded up beef of some sort.
And, no, it was that was good.
Rice and black beans and things.
Excellent.
It was quite good.
Fantastic. Here's Dawn Taylor at the news desk.
Human remains have been found in an undisclosed area on Mount Hood. Clackamas County Detective Jim Strovink said over the weekend the unidentified remains of one or two people were found and a recovery mission would happen in the next few days. Strovink said the recovery effort would be technical and challenging. In 2009 and also in 2006, teams of three climbers perished on Mount Hood. In both cases, only one of the climbers' bodies was recovered.
I don't get it. Why are they these? But this isn't like a guy who vanished last week.
No, it's just somebody found human remains and they're like, well, I guess we should go get those since it's not, you know, since it's summer and everything, we can actually get to them now.
But it's still covered in snow. I mean, it's still going to be tricky. Why are they just, you know, on Everest, we've talked about this, on Everest, they just leave you there. You die in Everest, you stay on Everest.
Yeah, but
it's a little bit of, you know, then it's a little bit of color as you're climbing, a little bit of, you know, it's like a theme park then on the way up.
Well, there is this thing, too, where when people are weird, like, you know, if they don't find the body, even though the person has not returned from Mount Hood.
Right.
These people are sometimes still in denial about their loved ones being dead.
Like living in a cave up there somewhere.
We just need you to confirm that that really is them. It's like, really, well, where else would they be?
I need closure. Maybe I can just take a photograph, you know, and just sort of look, here he is. Here he is wearing a funny hat. Here he is being wheeled around by Andrew McCarthy.
But there have been like three or four cases over the last like 4 years where people have gone missing on Mount Hood and they didn't recover the body. So I think basically they're just going to kind of haul them down and sort them out and figure out who they are.
If I ever want to disappear, by the way, I'm going to tell everybody I'm going hiking on Mount Hood, and then I'm just going to go to South America or something. And they'll just be like, he's still up there somewhere. You know, and then they'll look, and then their eyes will turn to the snow-capped crest. And meanwhile, I'm going to be like on the beach somewhere with a whore. So I'm not calling my wife a whore. There's no way that sentence makes me look good, by the way. No, because then either I'm there, either I'm calling my wife a whore or that I'm just there with a whore and my wife is somewhere else.
Your wife is sad thinking that you perished on a snowy mountain top. Of course, she would probably know better because she knows you're not going
hiking.
Because
I'm not a rugged outdoorsman. Unless we're both there and we both have different whores. It doesn't matter. Here's Dawn Taylor.
A 34-year-old man celebrating a bachelor weekend was found dead on the bathroom floor of a Brown County, Indiana vacation cabin early this morning.
Brown County, Indiana is the worst place to die. It has to be. Brown County sounds like when you have diarrhea, but they're too, like, I don't want to talk about it openly.
Coroner Earl Piper is scheduling an autopsy in Seymour, Indiana, to determine cause of death. He's not releasing the victim's name pending notification of family.
Coroner.
Early Newmer.
Damn it.
Brown County Sheriff's Deputy Chad Williams said the cause appeared to be natural. The group of five men appeared to have been drinking Friday night at Above It All Lodge on Morrison Road in Helmsburg, Indiana. The victim was found in the bathroom about 4 or 5 hours after he had died, Piper estimated. EMS was dispatched shortly after 8:30 a.m. At about 11 a.m. Saturday, the victim's friends were scooping cans into trash bags on the back balcony of the four-bedroom log home.
They're all class.
Piper said he saw several beer bottles and cans inside. Piper said, judging from the man's medications, he had a history of heart and respiratory problems. He added that the victim also had, quote, probably spent more time in the hot tub than he probably should have.
You think?
When it's a 90-plus degree day and you're in a 100-degree hot tub plus alcohol, I'm sure that didn't help matters, Piper said.
Is that really the best thing you can come up with? It didn't help. He's dead. Didn't help matters.
Well, he's the coroner, and coroners are like that. I've talked to coroners about news stories, and they're like that. They see so much of this. It's like, well, yeah, 100-degree, 90-degree day, 100-degree hot tub, alcohol. That didn't help.
Well, they get this sort of wry sense of what are you going to do?
Yeah, no, he was completely rotten, and his head was missing. That'll happen. Yeah, you know.
Jesus.
The men were staying at the cabin to celebrate an upcoming wedding set for September. Piper said the victim worked with the groom-to-be. The two vehicles in the driveway had Indiana license plates, one from Tippecanoe County. Two more friends were expected to arrive at the cabin today.
That'll be fun. Hey, Bob, we're...
We brought beer.
Something smelled like Bob, but not like Bob. Do you smell old Bob somewhere? Here's the thing about bachelor. Well, you and I were talking about. Was it yesterday we were talking about bachelor parties? Because you had this whole thing about strip clubs, which
I just don't get.
Yeah, but and it's like the bachelor party. I only.
Why don't you read our spot first, and then we can like.
What is our?
Talk about,
what is it? I don't have the run sheet in front of me.
Why don't you have the run sheet?
Well, no. Here's now. Listen, you damn woman. I have two run sheets in front of me, but there's no dates on them, so I don't know which one is today.
Well. The one that I handed you earlier is
okay.
Today.
There's okay. No need to be smart.
The one that has today's show separated into hour one and hour two.
Is it the one that
the
says
current one?
Right here is this that right there?
That would be it.
All right. I'm just saying, there's no dates, and it's like you know.
I'm sorry. I will start putting dates on them then because I didn't realize you kept held them over.
I'm just
from
saying. Well, sometimes yesterday I had to. Yesterday I had to get out of the studio real fast because we ran over time and Sarah and Greg were trying to get here. So I shoved everything into a bag and I didn't do my normal end of show throw away everything we use.
Yeah, because for someone who likes things tidy, that is a stack of
Normally it's a stack of crud. Normally it's not like this. But again, yesterday, my whole thing is I have this
whole... Somebody in the text box suggests just write today on each sheet.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks so much. I have this whole after-show ritual about where I throw away everything we've used and stories and, you know, little notes from that are just that. But yesterday, I felt so bad that, like, on their first day back, you know, Greg and Sarah back, we're going to consume most of their time by just going massively over schedule. And we just kept talking. So I just shoved everything into the bag. And it's like if I don't do the cleanup ritual immediately after the show, it goes – and then it's, like, out of sight, out of mind. And it doesn't – so I don't – then it doesn't actually get done. So that's what happened yesterday. Which it means that today we had to delay by about 30 seconds here our discussion of the cleaning solution in the person of Michael Beatty. Now, I could make an all-too-easy reference to the bachelor party mishap here and the idea that – although, who knows? He might have to do that.
Yeah.
They might actually – he might – we should ask him if he does, like, criminal – you know, like crime scene cleaning or something, because somebody's got to do that, right? The landlord's not going to do
it. That is actually a specialized field, and it pays pretty well.
Yeah, because it's like, you don't want to get, you know, scraping granddad off the wall or something, and the family doesn't want to do that, and it's like the landlord, especially because the landlord, you know, or the manager, whoever, is just like some dick who gets free rent for living there and telling you to turn down your stereo every now and again. He doesn't want to go scraping somebody's, you know, lungs out of the rug. So, you know, so as a result, you might want to get a professional to do that. And that is the that's the thing about Michael. He's a professional, Michael Beatty. 971-533-3211. And I mentioned this at the top of the show. In response to repeated requests, we have now put the contact information for our various advertisers at rickemerson.com. You go to the contact page. You just click the contact button right there at the top. You can find out more about him. It's a locally owned and operated company, and it is very simple, but at the same time, not easy to do, but it is a simple concept. You will come to your home, come to your business, and whether it's the furniture, the upholstery itself, upholstery especially, or whether it's the carpet, whatever your feet might be touching in the house, maybe a combination of carpet and furniture, like a hassock, let's say. You need that to be cleaned. Michael Beatty can take care of that residential and commercial work and regular maintenance programs, and what that basically means is that it's that thing of like where you get it cleaned. As Elijah Muhammad said, one never knows that a glass is dirty till one holds a clean glass next to it. So once you clean part of the rug, and then it's like, you know, and then you go, my God, this rug is a totally different color. Then you keep it looking clean as well in the future. So you contact him at 971-533-3211, 971-533-3211, Michael Beatty, the cleaning solution. Here is Don Taylor at the news desk.
We're getting off of the stripper conversation.
Well, I was just to say this. I mean, we have two different things going on. One, we should talk about strip clubs at some point because we can either do that today or I think Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week is here tomorrow. And I'm trying to figure out if it would be, A, useful to talk about it with me and Aaron because then you get the perspective of two different guys. Me and then listeners weighing in. Me, Aaron, and listeners, or whether it's just going to become too creepy for words. I just don't know. There's that, and then there's the bachelor party thing, which I guess I might as well just say here, only because I didn't finish this yesterday, and somebody pointed out that I never finished this story. That I talked about going to a series of bachelor parties when I was young, and that I quit going because they were just creepy and sad. And the only one I've been to since then, I think, is Aaron Duran's, which was actually neither of those things. It was actually fine. I mean, it was, you know, and it was at a strip club and, you know, whatever. But it wasn't, you know, but it just avoided this sort of horrible, like, I regret everything stench that permeates a lot of bachelor parties. And again, that's solely because Jason Crump is just like a drill sergeant about things. But the last bachelor party I went to, other than that, was when I lived in Utah. And it's like, you know, in Utah, everything is so weird anyway, because everything is either really prudish and bland and like unfun. You know, it's like everything is like 2% beer, or it's like an overcompensation for that, where you go to a guy's house and there's just like crack vials, you know, and Thai prostitutes everywhere. This was it. First of all, can I just tell you where this bachelor party was? I swear to Christ, it was at a restaurant. It was at like one of those. What is that place on the? Is it called Banner's Pie House here? It was a place like that. It was a sort of sizzler that specialized like in pies.
A family-style restaurant.
Yeah, and they had like a little basement room that was like for, you know, like banquets or like your kid's softball game or, you know, grandma's 80th anniversary or something. But occasionally they would rent it out to like this guy for like bachelor parties. So we're in the – and it wasn't even called Banner's Pie House. It wasn't even – I swear to God, the place was just called Pies Pies. That's it. It was just called Pies Pies. There, that's where, and we're in the basement of Pies Pies, which is again, basically like a Sherry's, you know, but with a large empty room where they might otherwise keep like floor buffing equipment or something. So there we are in the basement of Pies Pies in Salt Lake City, Utah, ready to have our bachelor party, and we're for this the bachelor party for this guy. I almost don't want to give his nickname. I don't know what his real name was. I only knew him.
I want to know the nickname. I love nicknames.
The thing is, if I give his nickname, it's like there's probably not a lot of guys who have this as like a known. Not a lot of guys use this as the name by which they are primarily known. I'll give something very close to it.
Okay.
Let's say. You know how in the office there's always some jerk who refers to everybody as like big guy or tiger or sporto or, you know, hey, chief. Let's say this guy's name that everybody called him. Let's say it was Tiger. It was something very close. It was one of those things I just mentioned. But the only reason I know that is because it was it's very distant. I want to identify him because of the story, but we'll call him Tiger. So this guy, and that he had a name just like it was very juvenile to begin with. His name was Sporto. All right, are you happy,
okay,
you bastards?
Okay.
But the thing is, it's like Salt Lake, Pies, Pies, Sporto. Now, you know, 2 degrees of separate. Everybody probably will then know. You know, anybody in my circle of acquaintances who might ever hear this knows exactly who I'm talking about. But I guess you might have been there if you're one of those people. So whatever. Yeah, the guy's name was Sporto. I mean, I think his real name was like Jason, but no one ever called everyone friends. I think his actual fiance, the Sporto. How could you marry some guy named Sporto? And he looked just like a guy who would be named Sporto, by the way. Exactly like that guy. Which is to say, sort of like a less interesting Doogie Howser. You know, just so one of those guys that inevitably you're going to find humping the babysitter, you know, in 20 years. So we're at the basement of the Pies Pies. And some guy had put together the bachelor party for Sporto, and there we all are. And it's just in a big, square, empty, sad tile room, you know, tile and carpet and then empty bare walls. And, you know, we're sitting around and just drinking with our chairs sort of in a circle. And obviously the chairs are arranged in a circle, so some hookers or strippers or something are going to arrive at some point. But they're late, so it's a lot of horny guys on their way to being drunk, sitting in a circle. It's like an AA meeting where nothing is being confessed. And you were all sitting in a circle kind of going, so, big game last night. Yeah. Some weather we're having, too. You know, when are the hookers going to get here? And then finally there's like a knock, you know, like a knock at the door, and somebody gets up and answers. And it's like these two sort of beat-looking strippers who arrive, kind of underfed. You know, a little too much makeup, not quite covering the fact that they're aging rapidly, like aging sort of metrically. And, you know, and they're like 20, but they look about 70, and they're trying to cover it up with extra rouge. And one of them is carrying what in my day was sometimes referred to as a ghetto blaster. The sort of big, like, oversized boombox that has, like, the light-up EQ and, like, 17 speakers, takes, like, 100 D-cell batteries. One of them is just lugging that along with her. And they're like, hi, guys. And we're just – and at that point, I was already looking at my feet going, Christ, why am I here? But one of the guys who planned the thing was my roommate. So it's like I couldn't leave because then it's like I'd had – later he'd be like, what's up with you leaving? You know, and it's like I just – it would be awkward later if I left. And I'm like, okay, I'm just going to tough it out. And so one of the hookers or strippers like sets down – I keep saying hooker, but they weren't. That would at least would have been interesting. They were just strippers. So she sets down like the boom box and like turns it on. And it's like, you know, some Night at the Roxbury type song just starts playing some, you know, just begin to end. And at that point, I'm just like, Christ, like, what is going on here? Everybody, you know, the waitress appears every now and again with like a tray of drinks. And it's Utah. So
would
it's
you,
not like.
Would you like some pie?
Or pie? Pie, pie. So it's not like anybody's getting all that loaded either because I don't even think they could serve hard alcohol because it's so hard to get a liquor license in Utah. So they're serving Utah beer, which again is like 3-2. This is a microbrew or nothing at this place. So it's like everybody's drinking basically like Schlitz and trying to get drunk. And, you know, and so the girls are, you know, they're standing in the circle and the guys are all in a circle of chairs. And so the girls are standing sort of inside the circle and then they're dancing and then they're like fake sort of grinding on each other. And it's just sad. And it's, can I just tell you, here's another thing. Stop with the fake lesbian. We know that you're not really lesbians and you're not even doing it convincingly. If you're going to act like lesbians, at least, you know, I could show you how to do it. You know, if you're like, act like real lesbians. No, the whole fake pseudo-lesbian makeout thing is just so completely uninteresting to me. Because as much as I'm not into strippers, like, I guess if two chicks were just going to sort of get it on, I mean, at least then that's beyond stripping. But this is just sort of stripping and then kind of dancing real close to each other like we're going to somehow, like we'll be drunk enough that we think it's actual sex or that like maybe my glasses have gone out of focus and I think you're really getting it on. So that's, not, of course, not happening. And they're dancing in a circle, and I'm just feeling sadder and just – and that thing where you – have you done this where you feel better and worse about yourself simultaneously? You know, you're like, this isn't my bachelor party. I didn't plan this. I really don't want to be here. But I am here. And I'm watching. I'm part of this. And it's like you're just feeling horrible and great about yourself all at once. And so anyway, the girls are doing this. And then the – I forget in which order these two things happen, but at one point – I'll start with the less horrible thing. At one point, the girls are then just sort of working the room. They're like going in a circle and they're doing like – and again, these are just chairs in a circle. It's not like there's a couch or anything. We're in the basement of a pie place, the basement of, you know, like a Red Lobster basically. The girls are just going in a circle and then they're not – I don't even think they were fully nude. They might have been. It doesn't really matter. And they're giving you like the like a chair dance, which is like a lap dance, but they're not really sitting in your lap. It's like –
they're just near you.
Yeah, it's like if you were to sit in that chair right now and some girl were to come in and just come up and like put her cakes in your face basically and just kind of wiggle a little bit and then you're expected to give her like $5 for that. And, you know, and then the worst part, of course, or one of the worst parts is that like some of the guys are like really getting into it. You know, like my some friend of mine, he like takes out like a five and he does something really clever. Like he puts the five over the bridge of his nose and then puts his glasses back on so the five is sort of pinned there. So the girls really have to like work to get the five out. You know, like with their teeth or something. And I'm just sitting there thinking, like, I wish we were all dead. you know, and it's the fact that any of these guys are getting married or are married is just astounding. And so the girls are, and I did something that maybe, I'm not trying to make myself sound like a Boy Scout because it's not, I'm not, again, I would say, I'm not a prude. I'm not above.
You stood up and you said, ladies, please put your clothes back on.
I mean, I did something maybe just a few shades away from that. And again, let's be honest. I'm not saying that I am somehow the pure as the driven snow or whatever. You know, Rick Emerson is just a man. But there's just certain things that are just not a turn on and they're just completely like a turn off, even as a guy. And so the girl gets to me and she starts and I actually just said, I did the thing like when you're standing on a hard 17 at blackjack. I just waved my hand. And I said, "Not for me. Just you know, just move, next guy, move along." And she kind of stepped back and she sort of like looked a little bit offended, like with her hands on her hips and like cocked her head, like you know, hearing her master's voice. And she said, "Like what?" And I said, "You know, it's fine. Just you know, go on to the next. I'm fine. I'm all set here. And I did that with the next girl, and it was just like it was just like completely disgusting and it just gross. And you know, because I don't want to. You know, it's like you can't. It's either sexy or it's not. And if it's not, then there's no point. If it is, you know what? I don't want to be doing that in front of like all these dudes, especially if, you know, with all these other dudes around. And that's not even about being homophobic. That's just weird. It's just bizarre. And I is it like in which you know. And in a best case scenario, what is the best case scenario there? It's where the girl really turns you on. Well, then you're just turned on in a room full of guys and two chicks who won't do you. So they work the room, and I'm like, no thanks. Then they move to the evening sort of apogee, the apex, the climax of the evening, if you will, which is they get Sparto, and they move his chair into the center so we can all watch him getting the dual lap dance. And I will not draw the story out anymore except to say that not once, not twice, and again, this is Utah, where there are very strict laws about stripping. And unless you're really willing to pay a lot of money and you're willing to risk the idea that it's a cop, in Utah, there's, I mean, it's serious business there. Like, if you break laws, especially in a place that has alcohol and nudity, like, that is a hardcore offense in Utah. And they will, you know, like, you take licenses away and people have gone to jail. And so it's like rock and roll there. They don't screw around. So they drag this guy into the center, Sparto, and we're all watching him like some weird Lord of the Flies skull and bones thing. Somebody is calling here. Hold on a second. Sir, madam, if you're on hold, hang on. We'll get your call in a second. So we're all sitting here, and they start doing the dual lap, you know, the grind on him. And I swear to God, like three different times, because they've taken his shirt off, you know, so we can all feel a little icky. Like three different times, I swear to Christ, he just pulls his penis out and stand because he forgets he's so drunk. He either forgets he's in a place like in a Pies basement. He forgets we're all there. He forgets they're just strippers and they're not going to F him, or he's just so drunk he didn't care. And like three different times, he just pulls his junk out right there. And we're all like, whoa, no, you know, stop, you know, you know, please, you know, assist him. With those ladies, put everything away, you know. Just because, like, and again, it's, you know, if guys' unit, fine. Everybody, if we've all got one. Everybody's seen one. You don't. It was like on a deeper, horrifying level, you know, because at that moment you realized it was a shame that could never be undone. That was the last bachelor party I ever went to, except for Aaron Durant, which was not anything like that. Jesus God, it was just a nightmare. It was like a nightmare that you couldn't wake up from. Hello, sir, madam, as the case may be. You're on the Rick Emerson Show. Hello.
Sparto?
Hello, hi, yes.
Come on, Sparto.
I'm sorry, are you attempting, is this an in-character call?
What is Sparto?
Are you saying that your name is, in fact, Sparto?
You're a neo-maxi-zoom dweeby.
How funny do you think this call is on a scale of 1 to 7? Okay, thanks. Bye now. That sort of worked itself out there. I couldn't tell if it was a guy actually speaking or if he was using a Breakfast Club soundboard there. Hmm. It was one of the two. I couldn't quite tell. But it was not really going, I think, the way he anticipated or the way it needed to go for it to remain on the air. Thank you.
My only real experience with a bachelor party, I had a friend whose husband was hosting one, and she asked if I would come over and, like, keep her company upstairs because she had a kid at the time. She has a small child. And so she was just going to stay upstairs, and they were going to do whatever raucous boy things they were going to do downstairs. Ugh. And I went, and we hung around, and we watched some TV. And then it was like, I'm hungry, too. Let's just creep down to the kitchen and get some. We go down, and we realize as we're going down the stairs that it's really quiet. And so we kind of peek into the living room, and they're all just sitting around watching porn, not talking to each other.
See, that's just weird.
And I'm like, and so we're kind of like, that's creepy. And a couple of the guys spotted us peeing, and they, like, you know, sort of cross their legs so we can't see that they're at all aroused. So we go into the kitchen, and then, like, sort of one by one, like about half of them followed us into the kitchen. Like, what are you doing? Making a sandwich? Can I have a sandwich? Because they were bored. They were bored out of their minds.
I mean, well, that's the thing, because I think all the stuff that chicks think happens at bachelor parties, none of that stuff happens. I mean, I'm not saying it never happens. There are times where that happens, and I guess everybody's been to a party where maybe all of that stuff did try. But that's the exception. Most of the time, it's guys just doing stuff that they would normally do. They drink and they fall down. It's just that one of them is going to be married the next week, and that's the only thing. So It's just,
and again, the whole point of like sitting around with a bunch of your buddies
watching porn
and unable to actually touch yourself because, you know,
because
you're in a room full of your friends. Like, well, that's kind of that's like deliberately not eating all day and then standing outside a bakery window.
Why
would you do that?
And I've been at gatherings, mixed gender gatherings or whatever, where like somebody would put on porn in the background, but it was always because like the porn was sort of bizarre or hilarious in some way. Like, you know, hey, I got clown porn or whatever. Or, you know, like, hey, check out this weird midget video that a guy sold me. Or somebody at one point had this video, and was it Black and Gray? No, that was just black guys and old chicks. It wasn't black and white. It was black. There was black and white, black and gray, and then something or other. And the other one was just, I think, just called Blacktop. But there was one that was like, it was all like Ron Jeremy and senior citizen chicks. It was like Ron Jeremy and like 70-year-olds. And see, and that's the thing is we were all like, oh, that's horrible. Put it on. And it was put on just so we could all sort of, but it wasn't like anybody was watching it thinking like, this is going to be sexy. because that's just strange. Even if there's chicks there, like you just like, you know, like you figure if there's men and women there and they're a couple or they could be a couple, like, they could just go have sex, and you know the rest of you could just you know, watch something that's not, as you said, going to result in all this weird, strange sexual tension in the room. The whole thing is just bizarre, and that's why I don't. That's why I don't go to bachelor parties, strip clubs, and strip clubs are the same. And you know the other thing, and like strip clubs, and I was just sort of leaping into the strip club conversation, but I will say the thing about strip clubs is. And I know that Portland is, again, I'm not, whatever. If you looked at a pie chart of our strip clubs here as contrasted, you know, with as part of the city economy, it's like 74%. And the rest is all just beer and coffee, you know, and like, and you know, and people leveraging, you know, the fact that they know Gus Van Sant. And that's it. So I'm not trying to bust on strip clubs. And I, you know, I have many friends that are strippers that work at strip clubs, whatever. I'm just saying it's not for me. And one of the reasons it's not for me is, as you noted, it's just like setting fire to money while reading Penthouse, first of all, because they're chicks that are probably never going to do you. And here's the thing. If just because they won't do you doesn't mean they're not going to do somebody. It's just not going to be one of the customers. I mean, strippers are maybe no more or less slutty than anybody else. But even if they're more slutty, it's not going to be with you, Chester. It's not going to be with some guy who's standing at the rail putting up a five. That's just not going to happen.
Well, the irony about the strip club experience to me from the outside looking is that the best I can figure is that for the men who go to them, I think that some of the satisfaction comes from some kind of a sense of power.
Right.
You know, she is dancing for my amusement. It's kind of, you know, there's a little bit of a debasement there.
Well,
you're paying money and they're doing your bidding. But in reality,
oh no, it's the other way around.
It's the other way around.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
They're in the position of power, and you're the pathetic schlub that they undoubtedly have nothing but disdain for.
That's, you know, Bill Hicks used to talk about that a little bit, and he had a little bit, you know, I don't know if he was just for the comedic purposes, but he used to talk about you know, strippers getting sort of, you know, uppity with him, you know, and whatever. And he'd say, like, you know, I can see your vagina for a dollar. Like, how much, you know. But the thing is, as you just said, when they look at a guy in a strip club, they basically just see like a meaty ATM. And that's all it is. My friend Jason used to go, and I've told the story about how he never got the idea that the strippers just saw him as like a hunk of meat holding a billfold. And he'd be like, I think she told me your real name. I think she likes me. I think she's going to come visit me at work. He would try to impress chicks by telling them he managed a toy store at the mall. He's like, I manage a KB Toys. And he'd say, like, you know, hey, can I buy you dinner? And she's thinking, you just bought me dinner, Jack. I'm just going to be having it with somebody else. Yeah, that is the thing where the chicks are totally running the table, as they say in the gambling world. There's no man is in charge of anything at that place. And if she is effing a guy, here's what. It's a deadbeat boyfriend at home. Who is busy maxing out her credit cards and probably humping her sister. And you will probably never get to F her because you haven't done prison time, which tends to be kind of where strippers gravitate.
Oh, and by the way, he's probably in the back room shooting pool with other boyfriends of strippers at the moment. And so if you try anything, you will be taken out to the parking lot and beaten up.
Yeah, I mean, and I will say this. I'm not trying to be down on strippers or whatever. You know, whatever. If I could strip right now, I would, if I could do that and make money, I would, this instant, I would go do it. And I know that this is a man, this is a man, woman, one of those retarded Mars Venus things or whatever. But I think, like a lot of guys, I always, you know, if guys always say, if I could make money doing porn, I'd do that right now. That's nature's way of balancing things out. That guys aren't allowed or able to do all the things they would do. Because then nothing would ever get done. We'd all be living in grass huts. The reason that guys decided to create a society is that they can't just sit around and just, like, F everybody they want all day. Because most, you know, because you got to work at it if you're a guy. It doesn't just get offered to you all the time. If I could go strip, you know, if I was a woman, I like to think that I would just go strip for like 3 years and I would be the girl who puts it all away and saves it and invests and then does whatever I want with the rest of my life. And that never works out. But you like to think that you would just go and you'd make a little bit of money with that. So I have no problem with people. And it's not like you can't date a stripper. I think it's only the once. I think I only ever actually dated one stripper in my life. But I mean, you know, she's a perfectly nice person. Nothing wrong with her. Any more than like any other broken chick that I dated. So, you know, whatever. I mean, she just decided to, daddy either paid too much attention or too little attention. What, you know, either way, she just decided to do something with those extra wrinkles in her personality. And that something was stripping. So I have no issue with that. But going to a strip club, you either are there with horny guys and then you're back in the whole situation of in a room full of horny guys and none of you can really do anything about it. Or in Portland especially, and I'm all for female empowerment and feminism and chicks taking it back and sisters doing it for themselves and whatever. You know, everybody reading Betty Friedan and burning a bra or whatever it is somebody wants to do. But in Portland, you are besieged in every strip club by a bunch of liquored up girls drinking Cosmos with their girlfriends and who are all out at a strip club because they think it makes them either edgy, because most of them, in my experience, don't really seem to be into the girls the way that you'd think they'd be if they're at a strip club. So they're either there because they think it gives them some sort of edgy outlaw appeal, or more likely and more common in my experience, girls at a strip club are there because they think it gives them this weird sheen of reflected quasi-lesbianism that makes them hotter to guys. Which doesn't work, by the way, because we see through it. We know that you're not really going to get it on with us and some other girl. We know that's never going to happen. But I think it tends to be there as a sort of lifestyle. It's like most of the girls in Portland that I have seen that go to strip clubs, it's like they're wearing it on some sort of personality charm bracelet as another facet that makes them interesting. And it doesn't. Just FYI. Confidential from me to you. All right. Here's Dawn Taylor.
Ah, let's read something, shall we?
You wanted to get the stripper conversation done.
I did. We did that.
There you go.
33 miners are trapped 2,300 feet below ground in Chile are depending on food, medicine, and supplies being dropped to them through a 4-inch wide tube.
I heard those guys might be there till December.
Yes.
The F is that? How can you? It's a mine. Isn't it a big hole in the ground?
Well, they're trapped in the mine.
Did there it cave was a, in? Or
yes.
Was it? Jesus.
Yes. Yes, the men may be trapped as long as 4 months while the shaft, a shaft wide enough to pull the men through is drilled.
Goddamn.
The miners already have been trapped for 18 days since a rock slide inside the San Esteban gold and copper mine cut off their exit route. A probe retrieved a note from the miners Sunday saying they were all alive and well in a cramped 530-square-foot shelter. They survived by sharing tiny portions of canned fish stored in the shelter room. Medics are now beginning to put down glucose water through a tube, CNN's Carl Penhall reported Tuesday, first starting off with liquids and rehydrating salts, and then in the coming days we'll put more solid food down. But psychologists say really it's the mental health that's their real problem. Forced confinement for months in the small, dark, hot space with many other people will pose intense psychological and emotional challenges. The men will have to help one another. Penhall said they will have to make sure on a day when somebody is feeling down and depressed that others will keep him there to cheer him up.
At least you've got your health.
Basically, you've got 33 men trapped in the size of a studio apartment in the dark.
Ugh.
Now there's going to be some lights put in, but the conditions are still very difficult. David McAteer, former director of the U.S. Mine Safety and Health Administration, said you have to deal with bodily functions and you have to deal with that kind of question. Then you've got to deal with the psychological impact. Now, I think the fact that they've made it 18 days is very, very positive. But the euphoria of making contact with the surface is going to last a couple of days. Then it's going to be a long slog.
So why does it say why it's going to take them till December? I mean, I know it's a mine cave in and those things are insanely tricky. But I mean, that's like 4 months. I mean, what is it?
I don't get the deal. It doesn't say here. I'm not sure. They're 2,300 feet below the surface.
That's like half a mile.
And they're going to have to like tunnel basically a brand new mine shaft.
Without caving it in.
Down, without caving it in, that will be big enough to pull a man through.
Wow. God, that sucks. I mean, I know that's like the dumb understatement, but I mean, that's just unbelievable. I can't even imagine that. You know, Mark Burnett right now is just like, you know, he just sees reality TV gold, baby. He just sees like a sort of a Big Brother kind of in hell thing happening there. But I mean, I can't even. I mean, 18 days is pretty impressive that they actually, you know, have made it that long. Is that how long it was before they made contact with the surface?
Period? That's how long they've been down here, period. But yeah, they finally were down there a good. I'm not sure how long they were before they finally contacted somebody. But they got the note from them saying they were all alive Sunday, and how they'd been surviving. So
I can't even fathom that. But I mean, you know, at least they've got that the sort of pipe that they're dropping food through. Because I guess that they can like haul out like waste and whatever, and maybe drop lights or something down there, or you know, or whatever it is that you. Whatever it is that you need if you're going to be in a mine for 4 months. I mean, in a studio apartment. God. And you just know that's one of those things where, I mean, that's
basically how many
the size of the studio.
Yeah, it's the size of the room we're in now with 33 people in it.
With 31 more people than you and I.
Yeah.
God. And you know the law of averages being what it is, one of those guys will crack within like a week. And then it's going to be a whole, look, we got to draw straws. Do we just kill Felipe now or do we wait?
And eat him.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing. I've just got that Timothy song just cycling in my head now, which I will not play because that would be in poor taste. We should break here and do Pop Culture Authority.
Okay.
In a second, as soon as I do this and mention the Emerson Grant. The Emerson Grant is something that's made possible in partnership with our good friends and longtime listeners at New Millennium Maintenance. Now, if you listen to Legion of News, as you should every weekday from noon to one on PDX.fm, you've heard all about this. The Emerson Grant will be awarded to 10 lucky souls per month, giving them a full month's subscription to the Rick Emerson Show and easing the burden of their existence by just a little bit. And it's a one-month subscription, basically 10 of those a month going out. And the way to qualify, now, if you are already a subscriber, you yourself cannot be, you can't win the thing, but you can win it for somebody else. In other words, you know somebody who is not a subscriber. They're not here in the show, but they ought to. Here's all you got to do. You make a YouTube video no more than 2 minutes in length. Somebody asked if it had to be 2 minutes. It doesn't have to be. It could be 5 seconds. Doesn't matter. No more than 2 minutes in length explaining why somebody you know ought to be given a one-month subscription to this, the Rick Emerson Radio Extravaganza. You send us a link to that. Don't send us the raw video. Just send us a link and send it to video@rickemerson.com. video@rickemerson.com. That's a 2-minute video or less explaining why somebody you know ought to get a free 1-month membership to the Rick Emerson Show. Send a link to that video to video@rickemerson.com, and 10 of those a month will be awarded courtesy of New Millennium Maintenance. New Millennium Maintenance, that is landscaping maintenance and nuisance abatement solutions for your neighborhood or home. There you go. That is the Emerson Grant, friends and neighbors. All right, so there you go. We'll be back here in just a few. We got more on the way. We have a corpse watch coming up, a religious nutcase watch coming up. And in just moments, we have today's installment of Pop Culture Authority, plus more. Don't forget, tomorrow, Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week will be joining us. And I believe Anna Griffin is going to be joining us not this week, but next week. And Peter Carlin, I believe, next week as well. So that's all. And then Terry Brooks, I think, next week. It's just too much. It's
so much to do.
I mean, really, it's just mind-boggling. So all that is on the way. Back after this, you are listening to the Emerson News Network. What is the punchline to Bender's joke in The Breakfast Club?
From the Emerson News Network. This is Pop Culture Authority.
I'm Rick Emerson. A naked blonde walks into a bar with a poodle under one arm and a 2-foot salami under the other. The bartender says, "Well, I guess you won't be needing a drink then." The naked lady says, "Well, all right." What exactly the naked lady says then has consumed terabytes of speculation. Entire websites have sprung up, flourished, and gone silent under the weight of this existential musing. This is, of course, the joke begun by Judd Nelson's character, John Bender, in the John Hughes classic, The Breakfast Club. Bender, of course, who, by the way, was also the inspiration for the name of Bender Bending Rodriguez, of Futurama fame, falls through the ceiling of his high school and never gives the joke's punchline, which has vexed 25 years worth of fans. Some have, of course, taken it upon themselves to finish the joke, sort of a homemade two-sentence kind of fanfic. Here's some do-it-yourself punchlines, setup of the joke included. I guess you won't be needing a drink. Naked lady says, I'd like a screwdriver, please. Bartender says, rough night. Naked lady says, no, I just need to loosen up. Or, bartender says, I guess you won't be needing a drink. Naked lady says, funny, that's what the poodle thought, too. So you can see our problem. Without knowing how the joke is supposed to unfold, creating our own ending is a bit tricky. Now you know how that Stig Larsson guy's agent feels. Now, get ready to be even more disappointed, or perhaps pleased, depending on your philosophical bent and or need for resolution. A punchline to the joke was never written. In an interview in now-defunct Premier magazine, John Hughes and Judd Nelson were interviewed, and they were asked about the joke and whether a punchline existed. John Hughes said, there isn't one. That was the whole point. There is no punchline. Judd Nelson says, I made the joke up. My line when I fall into the room is, I forgot my pencil. So we were trying to work backward from that. But what joke would have that punchline? So there are two revelations here. One, that Judd Nelson apparently created the joke. And two, that it has no actual ending, which, in a cosmic sort of way, leaves part of John Hughes' career with an ellipsis and not a period, which is something for which we can all be grateful. Sincerely yours, Rick Emerson.
The final word on the only knowledge that matters. Pop Culture Authority from the Emerson News Network.
About beauty and we sing about truth, $10 million a show. We take all kind of pills that give all kind of thrills, but the thrill that we've never known is the thrill that it gets you when you get your picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Rolling Stone.
I wanna see my picture on the cover.
Rolling Stone.
I wanna buy 5 copies for my mother.
Rolling Stone.
See my smiling face on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
On my jeans, I got my poor old gray haired daddy driving my limousine. Now it's all designed to blow our minds, but our minds won't really be blown like the blow that'll get you when you get your picture on the cover of the Rolling Stone.
Rolling Stone.
I wanna see my picture on the cover.
Rolling Stone.
I wanna buy 5 copies for my mother.
Rolling Stone.
I wanna see my smiling face on the cover.
Got a lot of little teenage blue-eyed groupies who do anything we say. We got a genuine Indian guru. He's teaching us a better way. We got all the friends that money can buy, so we never have to be alone. And we keep getting richer, but we can't get our picture on the cover of a Rolling Stone.
Rolling Stone.
I wanna see my picture on the cover.
Rolling Stone.
I wanna buy 5 copies for my mother.
Rolling Stone.
On the cover of the Rolling Stone. On the cover.
And now, from the news desk, this is Dawn Taylor.
The body of 16-year-old Puyallup girl Kimmy Daly was discovered Monday evening in the South Hill neighborhood, and one person is in custody, according to Pierce County Sheriff spokesman Ed Troyer. Kimmy Daly had been missing since 1 p.m. Tuesday when family members said she was going to a friend's house. Family members told police that Kimberly was developmentally delayed, possessing the mental level of a 9-year-old. Pierce County authorities searched for the teenager for almost a week before discovering her body near the intersection of 122nd Street East and 115th Avenue Court East in Puyallup's South Hill neighborhood. Pierce County Sergeant Mike Blair said the body was found at 8 p.m. on Monday, about a half a mile away from her home. Ed Troyer said that Pierce County authorities had an 18-year-old male in custody. Blair said police followed the 18-year-old man to the body.
By the way, I'd like to congratulate you for saying Puyallup correctly twice. Well
Thank
done.
Thank you so much.
It was always a point of pride with Tom Likas that he would say that correctly. He said he just memorized it by rote like 1,000 times because he didn't want to. He figured that people would not. People would be impressed if he were able to nail that. Let's put it that way.
Well, you heard me ahead. I was sitting here going Puyallup. You're close. It's Puyallup. I'm like, damn it.
Yeah. It's close enough for jazz, as they say. It doesn't. You know. You were within striking distance. I just wanted to help you get the last inch there. All right. Here's Dawn Taylor.
Let's do our religious nutcase watch.
Here is your religious nutcase watch for Tuesday, right here on the... Do you have both pages?
No.
It's a two-page story. You're only holding the first one.
Well, I lost the second page with... It only had one sentence on it.
All right. Well, it doesn't matter. Here's your religious nutcase watch for Tuesday. Now, you have to quit obsessing about it.
Okay.
If you say it doesn't matter, then you can't quit.
Okay.
You can't look for it
anymore. I'm done looking.
Are we ready?
Yes.
Here's your religious nutcase watch for Tuesday on the Rick Emerson Radio Program. No. I mean, it's fairly lengthy anyway, so it's not like you're compelled to read the whole thing.
We'll usually only get about halfway through the stories before we move on anyway.
It doesn't really matter. All right.
A Saudi man convicted of paralyzing a fellow countryman with a cleaver attack is being threatened with having his spinal cord cut in a tit-for-tat punishment. The ultra-conservative Desert Kingdom enforces Islamic law and on rare occasions meets out punishments based on the ancient code of an eye for an eye. The case judge in the northwestern province of Tabuk has sent letters to several hospitals seeking their advice on whether it's medically possible to render the attacker's spinal cord non-functional,
which
local newspapers said.
You'd think Saudi Arabia would know that at this point. I mean, this can't be the first time they've done it. Wouldn't you figure there's already been a case study? How hard could it be to find some other guy whose spine they snapped in Saudi Arabia? I mean,
you'd think if anywhere they would have done it then.
I like the idea that there's a legal tit-for-tat principle, though. That's sort of like a consulting a, people versus losers weepers, 1917.
One leading hospital reportedly said it is possible to cut the spinal cord, but it was not clear whether it is prepared to do so.
Well, that's good of them.
The punishment can be waived if the victim chooses to accept blood money in reparation. The same also applies in capital cases such as murder. There have been several instances over the years where the convicted murderer's life has been spared at the 11th hour when his victim's family has eventually decided to show mercy. Despite the rash of ultra-modern buildings, Saudi Arabia remains a deeply traditional country. They follow Islamic law, and some sentences still follow the ancient code of an eye for an eye. 10 years ago, an Egyptian worker had an eye surgically removed in a Saudi hospital as punishment for disfiguring a compatriot in an acid attack 6 years earlier.
It's just got to be the weirdest day at work. You know what I mean? Where it's, you know, it's like your appendectomy, tonsillectomy, cops bringing a guy to have his eyes scooped out.
Right. Human rights groups find the practice abhorrent.
Yes, really. No, okay, there you go. Yeah. There you go.
So to recap,
Saudi
man attacks a guy with a cleaver, and so as punishment, they want to sever his spine.
Our partners in peace, Saudi Arabia. There you go. There's our religious nutcase watch for Tuesday. It's the Rick Emerson Radio Program. In a few minutes here, we'll talk about a recent addition to the Rick Emerson stable of sponsors and business partners. This, however, is Dawn Taylor at the news desk.
Approximately 500 Coke employees from the Teamsters Union went on strike Monday afternoon. The strike impacts six locations in western Washington. Members were picketing outside the Bellevue location Monday night. The union says Coke plans on closing several locations despite making a large profit. According to the union, approximately 500 Coke employees from six Teamster locals across western Washington went on strike at 5 p.m. Monday in response to the company's surveillance and intimidation of its employees and its refusal to bargain in a contract
and
in good faith.
This is in Washington State?
Yes.
All right. Where does it? I'm sorry, you must have said it, but I missed it. Where in Washington?
Six locations in western Washington, one in particular at Bellevue.
All right.
The union says the National Labor Relations Board is investigating the company for serious and repeated violations of federal labor law, including surface bargaining, which I don't know what that is, but surface bargaining, surveillance of its employees, and threatening to retaliate against workers for engaging in protected activities. Bob Phillips, spokesperson for the Coca-Cola Bottling Company of Washington, says that's not true.
Oh,
we've been flexible and have followed all federal and state laws and obligations. The union says a key sticking point in the negotiations have been Coca-Cola's insistence on raising health care premiums by 800% and eliminating health care coverage for Coke retirees. Phillips says the figures are wildly off base and says the company is pushing to eliminate the retiree coverage for new hires only.
I don't even understand. Well, I don't understand many things about this story, but never mind. I was going to interject something, but it was going to take us down a whole different road. The short version is, I mean, that sucks. On the other hand, I don't really understand what, if any, resolution we ever had with the whole healthcare thing. I mean, I know that, on the one hand, there's getting nothing. On the other hand, there's getting everything. And I know that neither of those happened. But I don't understand exactly where on the zero to everything scale we landed or when it happens. Basically, all I know is that in Massachusetts, if you don't buy healthcare, they stick you in jail. That's it. That's like the extent of my knowledge about how the whole healthcare thing ended up. You know what I mean? It was like, I don't know what the resolution of that was. Taylor in the back.
I could have told you a few months ago, but at this point, it's kind of faded into the foggy recesses of my brain.
Yeah, I don't even I just have no idea. And I'm not saying that it was even anything bad or that it was whatever. I just don't know. Because, again, they started with like the whole single payer thing and everybody sort of dug in their heels against that or whatever. And I guess they ended. I mean, I don't really hear them discussing it at this point. So I'm assuming that either they all just sort of secretly agreed that it was not going to get done and that we were just not going to bring it up anymore. Or, I don't know, other. That we achieved some sort of middle ground, because that would make something like this sort of less awful, right? I mean, if the idea was that we actually had some kind of healthcare system that was going to be put in place, then it would matter less if your employer is shafting you out of your healthcare coverage, which certainly seems to be the case here.
Yeah, the problem being that reforming the actual healthcare system is such a gargantuan task that I think at this point what they're really trying to do is just make sure that there's something available for people who can't get it otherwise. But there are just so many thousands upon thousands of layers of ways in which our healthcare system is broken and screwed up and unfair and messy that actually like fixing it so it works is just mind-boggling, just absolutely mind-boggling. Just as an example, one detail, I went to my doctor for my like yearly checkup, which I waited a year and a half to get a couple of months ago. And one of the things I mentioned in passing when we were talking about it was, prescription medications that my husband's company's insurance changes every year. They're a dental lab. And, everybody in the company basically uses their health care, which means that every year they have to shop around for a new provider.
Oh, that sucks.
Because the company they're with wants to hike up their premiums so much. So every single year in January, brand new healthcare, brand new program, which means, my co-pays are different. The amount of money I have to pay for my prescriptions is different.
Well, your doctor is probably different.
No, I've been able to
are
stay
you able
with
to
my
keep
same
going
doctor.
To the same doctor? Okay.
Yeah, so far.
So it's not like in other words, the doctor you're going to isn't like a
I go to a doctor, actually a nurse practitioner through a Legacy clinic, and Legacy is pretty good at taking as many different healthcare plans as they can.
To that healthcare plan,
right?
Then. Okay, all right.
But the thing is that my prescription drugs, the price I pay, change radically every single time. And this last year, everything just dropped enormously. Like it went from like me paying $15, per to like paying But they're all odd amounts. Like one is $3.17 and one is $7.43. And then something else that was the cheapest thing last year is now 15 instead of like five.
Almost like they're just spinning. It's like that. It's like the oil wheel they spin every month to figure out exactly how much gas is going to be.
Well, what my doctor told me is that this is, again, one of the problems with the healthcare system is that every single insurance company negotiates their own contracts with the providers, the people who do
pharmaceutical companies.
Yeah, the pharmaceutical companies and with the providers. So it's like between you know, my new insurance and then what their deal is with the various pharmaceutical companies,
right,
and what their deal is with Walgreens, it's going to change, you know, right? So this is part of the reason why, you know, the pharmaceutical reps get paid as much money as they do to go and, like, schmooze the people at the insurance companies,
right,
and vice versa.
And that's why every time you – everything you see at a doctor's office that is free, whether it's like a pen, a steno pad, a wall calendar, all has the name of a drug company, yeah, on it and the name of a specific drug on it. Because the drug rep – drug reps are basically like record reps, you know, where the record rep, you know, would come to the radio station. He'd say, hey, I got your brand new releases for this week, including that new Scorpions record and a bag of cocaine for you. And also, hey, I got that new Led Zeppelin box set for you. And it's, you know, and they're trying to convince the program director to add whatever lame new record it is by just giving them a bunch of free crap. I mean, that's what, you know, this,
yeah,
is.
Yeah, and the people who end up getting screwed, of course, are those of us at the bottom of the heap who are the actual patients.
Yeah.
And you end up in a situation where it's like, here, I'm going to put you on this pill that you need to keep, like, your blood pressure in check or something. And you're like, how much will this cost me? And the doctor says, I have no idea.
Right.
And you go and you get it and costs you like $10 a month. And you're like, great. And then your insurance carrier changes or they renegotiate their contract. And all of a sudden, oh, yeah, that drug you need to live, it's now $26 a bottle.
Well, you know,
and there's nothing you can do about it.
And I'll be really, really honest. I mean, I lived most of my life without insurance. But I am very fortunate right now in that I have insurance. But it is – at the same time, it's sort of freaky, though. I mean, I realize that I'm lucky, but it's also a little terrifying because – when I get all my statements or whatever, like, you know, like the trazodone and the whatever and all the, you know, the junk that comes in, like with prescriptions, it's the worst because you look at the thing, when they send me like my refill or whatever, and I look at it and it says like your prescription refill has cost you, you know, $18.72. You know, due to insurance, your savings is $455. And I think to myself, Christ almighty, like that's how much it would have cost me.
Yeah.
It, you know, I'm paying $18 or whatever, and it would have cost me $509 without insurance. So, again, I'm glad I have insurance. On the other hand, you realize just how screwed and how effed, A, many, 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 like 40 million people are, how effed I was for most of my life and how it's a miracle I'm not freaking dead, you know, and then how effed I would be if that were to change in some way. Yeah, it's just all right. There you go. Well, now I'm grumpy. Sons of bitches. I'm just saying, you know. A little.
I also understand, though. It's like I don't ever shop at Walmart for anything because, you know, they're Walmart. But I understand why people would sign up for their prescription drug program. They have this program where it's like every generic drug is like $6.
Right.
And I guess Walmart is so huge. And first of all, they can negotiate great,
because they're massive,
you know, contracts,
yeah,
with the pharmaceutical companies. And also, you got to figure, they're figuring, well,
it in bulk.
Yeah, we're going to make money on some of these. Yeah. We're going to lose money on others, but we're going to have so many people coming in.
Yeah, we got 200 million customers.
Meanwhile, you've got people who are going, well, you know, at least I know what it's going to cost me.
Well, and that's my thing with, how do I put this? You do understand in some sort of reductivist way the appeal of dictatorship. You know what I mean? It's obviously that's an oversimplification, but you do get the idea where if you're a guy like Fidel Castro, who's like hiding in the shrubs, you know, with his band of merry men and a bunch of machine guns, and you see what you perceive. And I'm not saying things are hunky dory in Cuba, but I'm saying that you do understand where. You can see from where the perspective comes that, like, well, the only way to solve this is just to wreck the joint and then to start again with me making the decisions. And things haven't really worked out, despite what Michael Moore would have you believe. Things have not worked out for most folks in Cuba in most real-world ways. That being said, there is a certain clarity and a certain simplicity of purpose and idea and execution, so to speak, that comes with just saying, well, now I'm making all the decisions and, you know, like it, there's the ocean. You can start paddling. And you, by the way, are now going to start charging $5 a bottle for your drugs. And that's the end of the discussion. You, by the way, are going to start charging $1,000 for a car. End of discussion. And if anybody gives you a little bit of back talk, you know, then that guy's hung above your fireplace the next week. So it didn't really ever work that well in practice. But my final observation is, and don't get me wrong, I am a huge fan of universal health care, of single payer. I won't even like gild the, you know, the lily or a phrase, whatever that phrase means. I won't even sort of parse it and say, well, I think we need drastic reform. I think there ought to be because they always compare it to the Canadian healthcare system, which is a totally false argument, because in Canada, although they have just now started to modify this in certain provinces, in Canada, they always say, well, it fails in Canada. It sucks. You have to wait ever for a doctor, which is true in many cases. But what they don't tell you is in Canada, the reason for that is because there's no private health care in Canada. In Canada, they've gone the other spectrum. There is no private health care. There's no private medical industry in Canada. In Canada, it is like the government or, you know, like you do it at home with a scalpel, clenching a belt in your teeth. They are just now starting to introduce a system of like, well, you can go to the free government thing, you know, and get it whenever you, or you can like pay and get it done privately. It's up to you, citizen. That's what we really need. Like, look, hey, you got your own money. It's like I can either go to Borders or Powell's and buy a book, or, you know, I can go to the library. Now, at the library, book might be a couple weeks in the offing before I get it. Might take a while for it to show up, but it'll be free. Or I can go buy it today. That's the way healthcare ought to run. You got money, you can go do it yourself, you know, and it's whatever. You know, you just, and if you don't mind dealing with it, you know, if you don't have any money or you want to save money, you don't mind dealing with the jive of having to wait months to see somebody or to not maybe have the doctor of your choice, you ought to be able to have that right too. The government ought to just pay it flat out 100%. So there you go. Rick Emerson embraces our socialist overlords, in theory. Here's Don Taylor.
It's been a long summer. Do you remember where the school zones are in your neighborhood,
no.
Rick Emerson?
No.
AAA is reminding drivers to be safe, take it slow, and watch for students as they maneuver their way to school on foot, bike, and bus. Jennifer Hubner manages their traffic safety programs and says, limit your distractions on the road.
Looking away from the roadway for even 2 seconds can double your risk of getting into a crash. And we know that 1 out of 5 motorists have admitted to texting while driving or even reading emails. So that's quite frightening, especially if you're in a school zone where a student might be crossing.
I would like to know, by the way, I caught my wife texting while she was driving. And I normally don't care, but she was driving me. I was in the passenger seat. And that does not play, as the young people say.
I think I have to take issue with her figure there.
What was her figure?
That
looking away from the roadway for even 2 seconds can double your risk of getting into a crash.
Right there?
Yeah.
Well, who knows? I guess it depends on the velocity. And they're probably, you know what they're doing? They're probably looking at all drivers at an average speed on the average road in America. And that factors in highway driving. It's like there's that thing. Here's the thing that I've always taken issue with. They say that when you sneeze, if you sneeze while you're driving, because your eyes close so they don't pop out of your brain or whatever, when you sneeze, you are effectively blind for 100 yards, which seems – that's like a football field. And it doesn't seem like that's really possible unless you factor in guys going 75 miles an hour or higher, in which case maybe it's possible.
I just – you know, it's kind of that looking away for 2 seconds can double your chance of a crash. And I kind of feel like – there's a whole lot of other information in that statement that is not being offered.
Well, now, look at it. If you are talking about, though, driving in a school zone during hours before or after school, mm-hmm. like when the crosswalks are going to be filled with children, I guess that's true.
I just said that. You know, looking away for 2 seconds while driving in a school zone could double
children.
Your chances of plowing down a child.
But not like in general. No, I'm with you on that. Yeah. It's no.
Hubner manages their traffic safety programs and says it's important to watch for students in unusual places.
They're really unpredictable. A lot of times children can cross mid-block or not even at an intersection or come out between two parked cars and you just wouldn't even see them. So drive slow and keep a lookout for those children that might pop up.
You might jump out of a tree, like in front of your car.
I was going to say,
a raccoon.
In nature, those children would not be allowed to have their own stupid children in the future. That would all work itself out. Oh, he jumped out in front of a leopard. Oh, okay.
Huebner says parents can be a good driving role model for their kids.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is there a third one?
Yes.
I don't think there was a third one. Yeah, I lied. I don't think I have the third one. That didn't really matter. Well. It doesn't really matter because it's an opportunity, Don Taylor. Speaking of schools, to talk about Castalia Language Center. That's a small private school in downtown Portland that offers Spanish language classes for adults. Now, you lived in California, specifically in Los Angeles.
I did indeed.
And now, granted, Los Angeles is not necessarily like the rest of the country, but what starts in L.A. or New York, they always say, just inevitably, you know, it rolls over the rest of the country like a spreading, like a tipped over gallon of paint, eventually covering and smothering everything, both good and bad. But one of the things that you probably experienced in Los Angeles, maybe earlier than or to a greater degree than maybe folks in the rest of the country, is the need to be fluent or at least to have some kind of passable Spanish language skills, depending on where you're going to be.
I did first have the option to take a language in junior high school and was offered Spanish or French. And I wanted to take French. And my mother said, "You live in Los Angeles. You're taking Spanish." And so I did.
Now, can you speak any Spanish at this point?
Not really, no.
See, and this is my thing, is that, like, they shouldn't even...
I know enough to read stuff off of, like, signs. Like, you know, I can go, "Hey, that's the taqueria." You know, that's pretty much it.
I mean, I kind of got the whole, like, baño. That's it. Jigsaw, when you got to go, I don't know.
Like, El Sol. Oh, that's something of the sun. That's pretty much it. I can't actually talk to people.
This is one of those things where every time I think about... We had that story last week about how they're still teaching kids, like, cursive in certain schools. When I think about the hours they spent teaching me how to make, like, a lowercase q or something, when they could have actually been teaching me Spanish, which is a massively useful language. And I mean, like, within the borders of the continental United States, it's a massively useful language. It is, and there are lots of communities and situations where it is equally, it is as important as or more important than English. And let's be honest. I mean, it is, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, you know, there's going to be a handful of languages that really dominate the globe, and Spanish, one of them. So you got to learn it now. And maybe it's like you put it off, or maybe you tried to learn Spanish at some point, you know, when you're in high school. But you're in high school, it's like you and you're 16 and you're distracted and you're, you know, and you're horny and there's 35 other kids and, you know, whatever.
They conjugate verbs. I got better things to do, you say to yourself.
That's the thing, is like you're just, and all you're doing is just like defacing the tennis racket guy in the peachy folder like everybody else and just, you know, waiting for lunch. So try to, again, you know, now that you are an adult and you can take it seriously. Classes are limited to 8 students at Castalia Language Center, so it's a small class load, which means the teacher's going to be able to sort of, you know, work with everybody and make sure that, you know, the other thing about public school, as much as they ought to teach Spanish sort of just as mandatorily there, the other thing is it's hard to tell if kids are falling behind because the teacher's trying to deal with 40 kids, and you can't make sure everybody's, you know, got all their questions answered. So at Castalia Language Center, the environment is comfortable. It's relaxed. Again, small class sizes, and it's adults only, which is important because... A, it's going to be people who are all equally motivated, and kids just learn differently than adults. It's a fact. The teachers are professional, they're friendly, and of course, it's all run by a woman named Clara, and she's from Argentina. She's a native Spanish speaker, and you can find out more about all of this at portlandspanish.com. Please tell them you heard it right here on the Rick Emerson program. Castalia Language Center. You can find out more about them at portlandspanish.com. This is Don Taylor at the news desk.
The White House is considering its next move after a federal judge's ruling against embryonic stem cell research. The ruling won't allow for federal funding of the research. Deputy White House Press Secretary Bill Burton says this reverses an executive order signed by President Obama in March 2009.
We're still reviewing the decision from this judge, but what we've seen so far, from what we can tell, this would also stop the research that President Bush had allowed to go forward early in his presidency.
You can tell they have no hope for this because they sent the deputy White House press secretary to talk about it. They farmed it out to like a AAA guy somewhere that has no credibility with anyone.
Burton says the president believes this work is vital.
We're exploring all possible avenues to make sure that we can continue to do this critical life-saving research.
Really? Is that it? Is that the best he can do? Hold on.
We're exploring all possible avenues to make sure that we can continue to do this critical life-saving research.
I guess at this point, we are only hopeful that the regulators will give us some clarity about their expectations, and then we can plan on that basis.
There really is no context in which this soundbite doesn't work. It's amazing. This is like the type O donor of soundbites. It goes everywhere. That's awesome.
Yeah. The problem with this is that apparently, from what I was hearing earlier today, the judge ruled that, you know, there can't no federal funding for stem cell research. but did not clarify, does this mean that there will not continue funding for things that had already been approved?
Or just no new funding?
Is it not going to be new funding? Are you going to have to, like, give the money back that you already got?
Because it's always important to have as much vagueness as possible in these things. And also, I'm so unclear about how the executive order thing, because I always say, you know, it's like you always think, if I was president, I'd just issue executive orders left and right, you know? And just about, you know, you there, you have to, you know, by tomorrow, you have to tell everybody what Martinizing means. I would everything I ever wanted done, I would just be like, executive order. I'd just get me a big rubber stamp, you know.
Because you would not be a president, you would be a dictator.
That, exactly. See, and so, so I don't, but if they can reverse it, then it's not really an executive order. Or maybe it is. I mean, I guess it is, but it doesn't really – it isn't what it sounds like it ought to be.
Yeah, damn
is my
this
point.
Whole democracy thing with checks and balances and people vetoing things.
I'm just saying
– I'm not being sarcastic.
It's part of
damn
the
it.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of the law. You know, so it's not like it's a thing he just made up. It's in the law. An executive order exists.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess maybe there is some – I guess maybe it lapses or something. Or maybe it's like a temporary sort of a deal. I mean, maybe that's – Maybe that's why he didn't do that, what's it called, ending the wars thing he swore he was going to do. Maybe it was just –
That is part of the whole thing of us not having a dictator, though, is that you have a president who, like, makes these statements and says, I'm doing stuff. But then you also have the judicial branch, which should go, you don't really actually get to do that.
Not going
to
happen ever. Sorry about that. All right. It is 2:59 here on a Tuesday. Let's see. Don't forget, tomorrow, Aaron Mesh from Willamette Week joins us. Also, we'll do this corpse watch, and then we'll, I don't know, we'll start the, because I got to go to that audition.
Yes, you do.
I have to go
you have
look
to go
like
be rugged.
A rugged outdoorsman. And I just don't even, I mean, really, I know that none of you all can see this, but I'm going to just, look, I mean, this is me. I mean,
Yeah. Well, you're not wearing, like, the girlier hipster jeans. You're wearing your more rugged-looking jeans.
I guess.
You're wearing, like, just Levi's. So that's better.
I, you know, and my other ones aren't, I mean, aren't that hipster. They're just dark. That's the thing.
Yeah.
They're like a darker blue.
And they're kind of weird, sort of almost a shiny sort of.
Yeah.
They're odd looking.
They're like, I think they're called, like. It's that weird. All I know is I bought them, and then it's like every time I touch them, my hands turn blue. It's maybe whether they're on sale. You can peddle any defective merchandise to me by making it a clearance item, because I never bother to check because I'm such a cheapskate. $14, I'm sold.
Yeah, to be honest, those other jeans kind of look like the jeans that kids would wear to school that everyone would go, oh, see, his mom buys him the wrong ones.
Really?
Yeah, they kind of do.
Well, but they were cheap.
Yeah.
And I'm married. It doesn't matter. I don't have to look.
Yeah,
and, you know, if I need to look good for something, I can wear these jeans.
Right, there
right
you
here.
Go.
Those are my other jeans. All right. Well, in any event, what was I just saying? Yeah, so tomorrow, I never even got a chance to tell you about this weekend's edition, but I will do it tomorrow when I recap today's sure-to-be successful audition. This is Don Taylor.
This is our Corpse Watch.
Here's your Corpse Watch for Tuesday on the Rick Emerson radio program.
I'm digging up bones, I'm digging up bones, exhuming things that's better left alone. But I'm resurrecting memories of love that's dead and gone. Yet tonight I'm sitting alone, digging up bones.
Here is Don Taylor with your Corpse Watch for Tuesday.
For those who are keen to leave a light footprint on the earth, here's one way to accomplishment. Aquamation, an eco-alternative to burial and cremation. With land for burials in short supply and cremation producing around 150 kilograms of carbon dioxide per body and as much as 200 micrograms of toxic mercury, aquamation is being touted as the greenest method for disposing of your mortal remains. A corpse is placed into a steel container and potassium is added, followed by water heated to 93 degrees centigrade. The flesh and organs are completely decomposed in 4 hours, leaving bones as the only solid remains. This is similar to what's left after cremation when the ashes are in fact bones hardened in the furnace and then crushed. Aquamation uses only 10% of the energy of a conventional cremation and releases no toxic emissions, said John Humphreys, chief executive of Aquamation Industries in Gold Coast, Queensland, Australia.
But then you had a big tank full of bones. What happens to those then?
Well, let's see. The decomposition process called alkaline hydrolysis speeds up the natural way that flesh decomposes in soil and water, he said. Similar methods for decomposing corpses have been developed elsewhere, but they decompose corpses at much higher temperatures. Humphrey says that aquamation, unlike cremation, will not destroy artificial implants such as hip replacements, allowing them to be reused. And after the body is decomposed, he says, the water is a fantastic fertilizer.
Well, that's great. But again, the bones. Seems like there's going to be a skeleton left over.
Well,
you're just going to sell that as a children's toy or something.
I guess you could also grind up the bones.
To make your bread?
And give them to people to keep in an urn. Or you could grind them up and you could also use those as fertilizer.
I don't know why that's so horrifying, but the idea of a urn full of ground up bones.
Well, that's pretty much what you get, though, when you get an urn full of cremated remains.
Yeah, but that's like the whole body, right? And that's not just the bones.
Mostly the bones, because when you think about how much of the rest of your flesh is actually water.
Right, but you're talking. But the one is ashes. The other one is ground up bones, which I think look different.
Well, have you ever actually seen or handled cremated remains?
No, cremains. No, I have not.
There are actually chips of bone in there.
Right, but I'm just saying. But like the one, I mean, I've handled ashes certainly, and I know that's not exactly the same thing. But I don't care. I'm just saying. Do you realize the one is ash, and the other one is just like taking a bone and putting it in a wearing blender for a while and going, here you go. Which seems sort of horrible. I can almost feel people pulling away from the speakers as we say this.
If the bones are actually like all intact and everything after the aquamation, I suppose you could probably you sell them to anatomical research or what have you.
See, that'll be a thing where they just that's how the government could make some money back. The government should say, like, look, we're going to give you free health care. Whatever you need, you get. But here's the thing: when you're dead, we're taking your body. We're taking it, and we're doing whatever we want with it. And that
I'm fine with that.
Okay, here's
I'm not going to be using it anymore.
Well, you know, and the other, because first of all, I don't want to start a whole thing. I have always, like, organ donation ought to be like a mandatory. Like, you shouldn't have any say in that. You're dead. We're taking your body, and we're parting it out.
Yeah, people do have these pesky religious things sometimes.
Yeah,
that
well, they
are
can, you know,
that.
they can get bent. There ought to be that, and you ought to be able to sell your organs if you want. But that's a whole separate thing. But you know, the government ought to say, look, we'll give you health care, but when you die, like we get your body, and then as you said, they can give it to a museum or to research or something. So, but maybe you know, but it's in Australia where life is cheap. So who knows what they do there? I have no idea how those people proceed. And I think we're done. Are we done?
That was the corpse watch.
That's your corpse watch. All right, there's...
I'm digging up bones. I'm digging up bones.
I want to be dissolved and then just give my bones to someone. Just will them to someone.
You don't mean like a stranger. You mean like a family member?
Well, I'm not going to really have any control over it because I'll be gone. But I could will it to someone. I mean, if I left it to somebody just really random that I didn't know very well, I'm going to leave my bones to Sean Levy, you know, or something like that.
That'd be awesome.
And he's like, why? And he'll never know.
Yeah. And it's just, you know, or maybe just like sort of a bone roulette where you just, you know, oh, you open up, you just open up the yellow pages or, you know, the white pages or whatever. You just pick a guy randomly from the directory and go, you know, and then just some guy like in Ohio who's never met you.
Or just hand out raffle tickets at my wake.
That's awesome.
And whoever wins gets my bones.
That's fantastic. Or they could each... you know, or it could be like one of those things where like they hand out all the bones at your wake, and one of them has a small green sticker on the underside, and that person wins the pot.
I do have it written in the instructions for my memorial that I do want to be cremated, and then I want my ashes put in little matchboxes and handed out to people at the ceremony. Yeah,
that's pretty great.
So it's like a little memento to take home with a little piece of me.
Just you know, maybe, or just they could just take me and make me into like a I don't know, like maybe a, like a knockoff Hummel figurine that is then sold at Goodwill for $3, or just inside a series of small decorative pepper shakers.
Yeah,
and then you know, and then left on the tables of unsuspecting diners the whole country over. That's how I'd like to be remembered.
So a little bit of Rick Emerson in everyone.
Exactly, giving the entire country sort of a brackish back of the mouth taste. All right, we should end now before we become more horrible. The Rick Emerson Show comes to you live each and every weekday from the studios of the Emerson News Network. At the news desk is Don Taylor. Advanced technology and magic provided by Thomas Gill. Executive producer Bruce Agler. Chief of staff Cheryl Kanakoa. The Rick Emerson Show is made possible by a generous grant from you. My name is Rick Emerson. It is Tuesday, August 24th, and that is The Frequency. Kenneth, thanks for listening. Be safe. See y'all tomorrow. And Legion of News encores next, followed by an encore of this very fine radio program. See y'all tomorrow. Bye now.
Attention broadcasters in the greater Portland area. Your daily show prep is now concluded. Thanks for listening.
From high above the milkpacking district in the heart of beautiful southeast Portland, Oregon, this, my friends, is Legion of News, a one-hour distillation of all important knowledge from everywhere. My name is Rick Emerson alongside Don Taylor, who is, even now, readying information about a vast swath of happenings, including, but not limited to, the following.
Corvallis police arrest a naked football player. Housing sales plunge 27% in July. And a woman on a bike collides with a garbage truck.
As always, my friends, have no doubt that this conglomeration of factual discourse and ideological screed will render you shocked, amazed, enraptured, and demonstrably more intelligent than when you began this hour. And now, pay heed, for this is Legion of News.
Good afternoon, I'm Dawn Taylor, and this is absolutely everything you need to know for Tuesday, August 24th, 2010. Corvallis police, responding to an early morning call about a naked stranger inside a home, eventually resorted to stun guns to take an Oregon State University football player into custody. Police said the young man refused to comply with officers' instructions to get down on the ground early Sunday morning. Instead, Sergeant Mike Mann said the nude man dropped into a three-point stance like football players.